highly politically sophisticated. In terms of how educated they are, you know, clearly they haven't gone to school. Most of them are illiterate. But in terms of the complexity of their political organization, it's really remarkable.
Our telephone number is 212-209-2950. You've been listening to an excerpt from our interview with Daniel Rasmussen. He's the author of this remarkable book that tells this story of how American power kept a lid on it for over two centuries. Over 200 years, they would not let any light be shone on what was the largest slave revolt in history. The largest slave revolt in history.
In the history of this country.
And they make it like these slaves were happy, content. They don't want people to know. And they were inspired by the revolution in Haiti. And the Haitians told them, yes, you can. And they had this revolt. They came, their goal was to take New Orleans. That's what they were moving. They were moving. They were mounted. They were armed. And there were up to 500 of them on horseback. And they were, and as they would move, if they saw any white, plantation owners, they just would eliminate them. And they were moving towards their goal. And they were going to do with New Orleans what the Haitians had done with their nation. 212-209-2550. You've got to get this most remarkable story. It is yours in a package with this interview, with the book, for $100. I tell you, you ought to kick in an extra 50 for WBAI just because we dared to bring this to you. And this is a remarkable, remarkable story.
We're joined in this studio now. We have some company with us. Kathy Davis, the public affairs director,
welcome,
has
Kathy.
Joined us in
well,
the studio.
Thank you. I just came in because I mean, this, for me, is one of the most amazing stories that I have ever heard.
Yes.
Because the amazing part of it is that I hadn't heard it.
There
yes.
you go.
Yes.
That's the amazing
yes.
part about
yes.
it.
Yes, yes.
212-209-2950. Looks like we might have one or two calls on the line. We need to have a full board of calls right now, and you can do that. You know, we're asking you to make a pledge of $100 for the book and the interview. It is one of the most amazing things that we have come across in a very long time, and I promise you, Earl was so excited when he heard about this, and he was thinking of you and making plans and, you know, calling back and forth with the publishers and meeting so that he could meet with this author, because he just knew how important it was and that you would honor this radio station and the work that he does to bring this to you. So please make that phone call at 212-209-2950. It is a $100 pledge for the book and the CD. And that's really a reasonable package. Oh. Very often, you know, a book and CD would be much more than that, certainly. 212-209-2950. You get the story from the author, the interview that Earl Caldwell conducted earlier today just for you. 212-209-2950. You know, we could have done it in another way, but he wanted you to capture this, to have this, because you have the book, you have the CD, you can share it. For those of you who are in school or have family, children, relatives in school, this is the kind of book that you will want them to have. And this really tells a beautiful story.
Yes.
I mean, the ending, it didn't go very well, I have to say. But, you know, we don't hear these courageous stories. And who's to say how many courageous events occurred
yes.
with the, during
yeah,
this
yeah,
era
we know nothing about.
That we
yeah.
wouldn't have known anything
yeah.
about
yeah.
because the repercussions were so horrible. You know, I heard the author talk about how they beheaded the people and
yes.
put their heads. I mean, this sounds like it's like the barbarism.
The Middle Ages, it sounds
it's,
like.
Yes. It's like an, it's unbelievable. However, the important thing is that, you know, we've spoken a lot about the Haitian Revolution and how inspiring that was to people around the world. Well, also, it was also inspiring to people right here in this nation, to those those early African American people who had had their liberty taken from them, who had suffered the indignities of slavery and the punishment of slavery. And they rose up, and they came very close. And maybe if we weren't isolated in this continent, and you know, maybe if the you know that uprising had continued to spread, our history would be a totally different history. 212-209-2950. Earl, have you offered the big package yet?
Well, we actually haven't played anything from it. I did say we have the $400. No.
It's a $200 package because we've been offering, in addition to this book, the
Kathy,
the
maybe
Say It Loud.
Yeah, okay,
the Say It Loud. It's a book and CD set, and it's you know, it's a hardcover book. The CD comes contained with it, and it's great speeches on civil rights and African American identity. So you can have this two book, two CD package for your pledge of $200. On the Say It Loud CD set, there are 22 talks, 22 excerpts from speeches. It's an amazing book and track list, including Malcolm X, Lorraine Hansberry, Martin Luther King Jr., Roy Wilkins, Benjamin E. Mays, Kathleen Cleaver, Bobby Seale, Ella Baker, Shirley Chisholm, Angela Davis, Vernon Jordan, Dorothy Height, James Cone, Toni Morrison, Colin Powell, Mary Frances Berry, Ward Connerly, Condoleezza Rice, Maxine Waters, Henry Louis Gates Jr., Michael Eric Dyson, and Barack Obama. All of that is on this CD that comes with the book, Say It Loud, Great Speeches on Civil Rights and African American Identity. And you can have this in combination with the offering that Earl was giving you just a few moments ago. And what's the name of the book and CD again? I don't have the paper for it. Oh, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. It's The American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt by Daniel Rasmussen. This is also a hardcover book, so you have these two books and the CD with all these speeches for your pledge of $200. It's a great premium. You'll learn from it. You'll be proud of it. You'll be able to share it. And this is information that so many of us don't have in our households for our families. If you're a grandparent, you're going to want your grandchildren, this is the information you want them to have to be proud of their heritage. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. You can use MasterCard, Visa, American Express. Break up your pledge into installments if you like, if you want the big package for your $200 pledge, or you might want either of the elements. That would be okay.
And, you know, Earl, I know you want to read those the names of some of the people who have called in already
who
with their
already
pledges.
Already have it, yes.
Of support. Ooh, but you know, in this book, Daniel Rasmussen points out the slaves did more than just plot revolt. They also shared valuable information, established networks of communication, and laid the groundwork for the pan-African slave culture of the New World. The informal networks that would sustain these men and women in captivity began to form in the dark holds of ships. The slaves shared their histories, established bonds of trust, and affection. And that's just part of the book. And just let me read one more portion of this book for you. The island accounted for over 60% of France's export trade, and more ships docked in the ports than in Marseille or any other smaller French port. That's, of course, talking about Haiti. As French ships brought Caribbean sugar and other cash crops to Europe, they brought back with them the processed goods of Europe, salt, cotton, other meals, brandy, wine, flour, and all manner of refined goods. This valuable colony drove a period of rapid economic growth in France and in Europe. More broadly, a period of economic growth that laid the groundwork for the Industrial Revolution. Whole factories, whole towns grew up to serve this vast new world trade. And as the tall-masted ships sailed back and forth across the Atlantic, Europeans watched their coffers fill with gold and the benefits of trade lift large swaths of the population from peasantry into the middle class.
So we were, black people were the commerce that created that benefit for all those folks. And, you know, I would say that that's still true. 212-209-2950 on some level. It's an amazing history, and it's something that we don't often have an opportunity to really look at in this context. This is a very progressive book, as well as revealing an event that's totally been denied from the history books.
Let me thank some of those who've already gotten through and have made the pledge to get the book. Emmanuel Johnson from Islip, New York, thank you very much. Teresa Mona Murphy from Yonkers, thank you. Angeline Giles from New York City, we have your pledge, thank you very much. Kenneth Talen from Staten Island, thank you very much. Maureen Hines from Randolph, New Jersey, thank you. Means so very much, we appreciate your support. Jovens Monocure, I know I'm mispronouncing that, Cure. Thank you very much. Have your pledge. John Hunter from Newark, New Jersey. Thank you. We appreciate it. Robert Richardson from Montclair, New Jersey. Yes, sir. Thank you very much. And Paul Blocker from Somerset, New Jersey. Thank you. New Jersey coming in strong, as New Jersey does. Listen, we're almost out of time this Friday. We ought to be overwhelmed at the, you know, so much of the time we don't get these things. Now we've got it. It isn't even just you as an individual. This should be in your house. You make these things available to your children. We portray slaves in a kind of way that this history shows has been a big bald-faced lie. These were heroes. They were daring. They were struggling and fighting for freedom. When they say the plantation owner was brutal, it's like the author said, they had to be brutal because these slaves were bound and determined to be free, and any time they had any little opening to go for it, they would do it. But this is a story of how they organized, got the wherewithal, and moved on New Orleans, and bound and determined they were going to take it over and plant their flag there. They were going to be free. This was just 7 years after the rebellion in Haiti. It inspired. It showed the slaves. It is possible. Yes, you can do it. And they rose up in this country. They didn't know what to do. And so what they said, we will do is this. We will never let anybody know anything. It will be as though this never happened. Are you going to let that be the last chapter? 212-209-2950. Give us a $100 gift and we will send everything to you. The author's interview with the author, the whole package. But I don't know what, maybe Michael G. has some better language. I don't know what else to say.
Not better language. Also, Say It Loud, Great Speeches on Civil Rights and African-American Identity. That is available, too. There is another portion. There's several more portions of this interview that Earl Caldwell had with the author of American Uprising, Daniel Rasmussen. We'll give you another little taste of that. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. We thank you for those calls that have come in thus far. Earl was thanking a couple of people for supporting this radio station, WBAI. 212-209-2950. Can we hear from you folks? Are you there with us? The Caldwell Chronicle with Earl Caldwell here on 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI. AI.org. Thank you for that call coming.
Are you with this? Are you with this? Are you with this? We need to hear from you. We need to hear from you now, because Michael G. and I personally, we argued for this premium.
Yes, really.
These stories have to be told, and we have to, I don't know how else to put it, but you have to give us your support when we try to do things like this, because we're saying that the audience wants it. We want these stories that are not told. We want to have these books and this knowledge and be able to share it with our children. And we want to end these stereotypes that said that these slaves were ignoramuses and dancing and all that craziness. It's as the author said. When he explored and did his research, he said he quit calling them slaves. He said he began to call them heroes because he could see these heroic things that they were doing. If there's one thing that takes my breath away with anger, it's this hiding of the truth. It's that we have all these hundreds of years later, these stories not told. This happened over 200 years ago. And they hid it from us. They hid it from us. They hid it from us, from you, and your children. We grow up thinking one thing, and then we find out it's a bald-faced lie because they hide the truth. What I'm saying is that we need to grab hold of every ounce of this and wring everything out of it with our children, our grandchildren, in our communities, and we need to go and confront these Kathleen Blacks and tell them this too must be a part of the curriculum. It is in our hands. It is in our hands, and we can do these things. But you've got to, A, support this station, B, get this book, get it, and get this interview. And also, we have this package. If you want to support us at the $200 level, we'll give you the whole Say It Loud package. That's this, another CD and the book with all of the speeches that Kathy Davis talked to you about. So these are important packages this Friday. This isn't just another ordinary Friday starting another a fundraiser. This to date is, my mind is revolutionary. It is breakthrough at a level that we haven't. Because what we have to do is gravitate and fight for these stories not told, because this is our history. This is we have been in this country. A lot of people don't even realize we have been here these many years. We've been here. He documents in this book about the economic might that came as a result of this slave business. You know, when the Haitians got over, when the Haitians threw them off, the French got their revolution. We call Haiti, and he'll speak to this on the tape, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. He says, yes, because the United States of America was punishing Haiti with trade, with all kinds of devices they use, say, to punish them. How dare you? How dare you? Oh, this is a struggle. This is a struggle for the truth. And bless us, because on this Friday, we do have some little piece to share with you. Please call us. Tie up these phone lines. Tie up the phone lines to WBAI this afternoon, because if you do, we can shed more light on other places. Don't sleep this. Don't let this moment of opportunity pass. We need your support. You want us to be strong? We can only be as strong as you allow us to be. You stand with us, and we will do everything we can do to share truth with you.
No record survives of just what Kuk and Kwamana said or how they plotted their uprising. But another revolt led by Akan people in New York in 1741 gives us a picture of how they might have operated. As in New York, the 1811 uprising involved a wide diversity of African peoples drawn from all over the Atlantic world and of many different languages and nationalities. American Uprising, the Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt by Daniel Rasmussen. We're offering it on the Caldwell Chronicle this very afternoon, this Friday afternoon, for a pledge of $90. Make your calls now, 212-209-2950. You can use your Visa card, your MasterCard, American Express. The book and the CD, the discussion that Earl had with Mr. Rasmussen, is available for a pledge of $100. Make your calls now, 212-209-2950.
Look back on this. What was the single most painful thing that you came across, and what did you encounter that you might describe as something that was joyous in the sense that it showed what the human spirit can do, even against the incredible odds that slaves encountered or had to deal with?
You know, I think the most frightening thing for me, the most terrible thing to come upon and to deal with, is the image of heads on pikes.
Right.
Of the brutality of chopping off another person's head and literally sticking it on a pole and putting that pole on the levee so everybody can see it. And that made for me so clear what slavery was based upon and what that economic system was based upon. That system was based upon heads on pikes, on not just forced servitude, but forced servitude enforced by tremendous violence. And so that was the most difficult thing for me to approach, to think about, was just the fear, violence, and terror instilled upon these slaves by their masters in order to keep them working. In terms of the joyous and positive, for me it was actually interesting that there's the story of this revolt, as unknown as it is throughout the rest of the country, has been preserved on the plantations, on the area where those plantations were. So people, residents of the German coast today, have kept this story alive in their family reunions. They've put together books of documents.
Mm.
They tell this story. They've preserved their own folklore that goes back all the way back to 1811. And so talking with those descendants of these rebels and learning that this story was so vibrant, meaningful, and alive today on the German coast was just, that's telling, right? I mean, that this event was so powerful that 200 years later, people are still telling that story in the same place to their own children as a symbol of the heroism of African slaves, and the contribution of African slaves to the making of this country was perhaps the most exciting moment for me.
Wow, that is stunning. So you were there in Louisiana for a long period of time?
Not for a long period of time. I only went down there a few times to get information that I needed, but most
right.
of the time I was able to get the archival stuff shipped to me up at Harvard.
Okay, but you did at some point actually meet some of these descendants, and were they readily cooperative with you?
I think absolutely. There's a man down there named Leon Waters who leads tours of the area. And there are African American museums down there that are fighting to preserve this history. And so I think they are desperate to have this story known by as many people as possible to get the word out.
Now, what about the other side? Just by the nature of this being a story not told for 200 years, and then here you come and you dare to tell this story. And you're also, as you said, 24 years old, and the number is 212-209-2950. We've got calls, we've got volunteers who are in place, and they are sitting and waiting for your call right now. If you've been listening to these excerpts, and if you've been listening to us talk about this remarkable book, a story so stunning that they put a blanket of secrecy on it that lasted for over 200 years. And we have phone lines open. That's not right. We've got to hear from you, and we have to hear from you now. This whole package is yours for a gift of $100. That's for the book and the interview, all in a package. It will take less than a minute for you to call. We need to hear from you. We know our signal, our voice comes into your communities all across this greater metropolitan area. We have so many things that we search and try to find that we know are right for our audience. In all of my years at WBAI, I've never had a premium to offer that I'm more proud of than this one today. I know we've had many wonderful, stunning things, but this is special. This is something, and it's all for just a very small gift back to the station. Please get on board, and get on board now. We only have 2 calls on the line. We should have 15 calls on the line. 212-209-2950.
212-209-2950. Yes, that's right, Earl. Just a pledge of $100 to read this phenomenal story, this phenomenal book. I don't know, Earl. There's something about black people that speak French, and they ain't having that slavery,
yeah,
clearly.
Isn't that?
I don't know what that's about, but proud that we can offer the story. 212-209-2950 is the phone number for you to call. Make that call. Pledge your support to WBAI and to the Caldwell Chronicle.
One of the things, we say slave revolt. What we don't say is, you know, they got right to New Orleans. They had about 500 slaves armed on horseback, and they got right up to the gate. And they would have been successful had not you had these tipping off of the slave masters, and they attack them, mounted this attack from the back. But this story is laid out. It reads like a novel, really.
You know,
but this is documented history.
Absolutely.
And Michael, there are these notes in the back of this book.
That's right.
You can find yourself where
yourself,
these things are.
Right.
So there's also, that's an added bonus in this.
Right. And not only that, Earl, but it's the fact that this story, I mean, what was going on there at this slave revolt, it's not only that they had horses and that they had armed themselves with large cutlasses and machetes and weapons of that day. They knew to put on military uniforms, those military uniforms that were cast off or that the fleeing planters left behind, and they knew that would give legitimacy to the slaves that weren't a part of the revolt to come and join them. They knew these things. 212-209-2950. That's why it's so, so very important that we get this out to you. And we're asking you to join us at the $90 level for a pledge of $100. We will give them both to you. We'll give the interview, the CD interview with Daniel Rasmussen and Earl Caldwell, the book, $90. Get them both together for a pledge of $100. 212-209-29, that's been doing that the whole day. That's why it's not ringing, Tony. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. And we're here in the final moments of the Caldwell Chronicle with Earl Caldwell. Thank you so much for those calls that are coming in right now. A few more calls. Again, that's Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton right here over WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
It is 2 minutes after the hour, and this is listener-sponsored commercial-free radio, WBAI New York, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming live on the web at WBAI.org, where these programs are also archived for a period of 90 days from the date of broadcast. I am Hugh Hamilton. The audio engineer is Mr. Michael G. Haskins, who is also our director of incidental music. Night has come once more to Cairo, and the Intifada, now in its 10th day, continues unabated. Here's how David Kirkpatrick and Alan Cowell are reporting the story for the New York Times at this hour. The Egyptian government broadened its crackdown on Thursday to the international news media and human rights workers in an apparent effort to remove witnesses to the battle with anti-government protesters. With fighting between anti- and pro-government forces escalating throughout the day, armed supporters of President Hosni Mubarak attacked foreign journalists, punching them and smashing their equipment. Men, who protesters said were plainclothes police officers, shut down news media outlets that had been operating in buildings overlooking Tahrir Square. An informal center set up by human rights workers in the square was seized, and a group of journalists were stopped in their car near the square by a gang of men with knives and were briefly turned over to the military police, ostensibly for their own protection. Two reporters working for the New York Times were released earlier today after being detained overnight in Cairo, and two Washington Post staffers were among two dozen journalists detained by the Interior Ministry earlier today, this from the Washington Post. According to the Times, the concerted effort to remove journalists lent a sense of foreboding to events in the square, where battles continued between the protesters and the Mubarak supporters, who human rights workers and protesters say are being paid and organized by the government. People bringing food, water and medicine to the protesters in the square were being stopped by Mubarak supporters, who confiscated what they had and threw some of it into the Nile. In the afternoon, the fighting spread beyond the square to the October 6th bridge, which rises above the Egyptian Museum. Shots were fired, and one surgeon assisting the anti-government protesters said that three people were killed. After the shots were fired, by the way, the army moved in to separate the combatants, and all this following a night of gunfire and a day of mayhem yesterday that left at least five people dead and more than 800 wounded in a battle for the Middle East's most populous nation. With the violence rising, the United Nations ordered the evacuation of much of its staff today, while more than 4,000 passengers made their escape through Cairo Airport, this according to the Associated Press. Meanwhile, as these bloody attacks on anti-government demonstrations in central Cairo continued today, Egypt's new vice president appealed for patience in implementing reforms but warned against unspecified conspiracies and flatly rejected opposition demands that President Hosni Mubarak leave power immediately. Omar Suleiman, a former intelligence chief and Mubarak confidant who was appointed vice president last week, said in an interview on state television that President Mubarak would keep his word not to run in the next presidential election to be held no later than September. Suleiman said that Mubarak's son Gamal, who had been considered his heir apparent, also would not run. Suleiman pleaded for time to finish a dialogue with opposition parties and carry out constitutional and legislative reforms, but he said that these reforms were essential to pave the way for fair elections in which the opposition would participate. His comments came amid a growing chorus of international condemnation as dozens of foreign journalists and human rights workers were arrested. We are joined now by Dr. Saif Dana, who is an associate professor of sociology and international studies at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, specializing in the Middle East and North Africa. Good afternoon, Professor Dana.
Good afternoon.
Now, to these events, as they're being reported, and I just quoted extensively from the New York Times and the Washington Post, based on your sources in the region, is this a reasonably accurate account of how events have unfolded today?
No, not really. I think the terms are very deceiving, and to characterize some of what's happening and attributed to Mubarak supporters is totally false. We have a tyrannical regime here with 1.5 million members in the security forces, and which essentially disappeared in the second or third day of the revolution or the uprising in Egypt, and they have been manipulated in various ways, and all the events that have been orchestrated essentially as rallies of support for Mubarak are utterly false. We know definitely, I mean, from scenes that everybody in the region saw on Al Jazeera, that they were members of the security forces, dressed in civil dresses. That's one side, one thing. The other thing is we know definitely also that the Egyptian government has been forcing, you know, government employees in certain departments and ministries to actually join some of, you know, they were forcing them to join some of these false rallies or orchestrated rallies. One of the best examples on this is the one of the famous anchors in the Egyptian run, the government-run TV in Egypt, who resigned simply because she said we were reporting false news 24 hours a day, and during our breaks we were looking at. Excuse me, we were looking at Al Jazeera to get the real news. So it's really a mischaracterization to say that there is a mass popular support or movement for President Mubarak. You know, the events on Tuesday simply showed about 7 to 8 million, according to some, actually, and I can say conservative estimates, of the people protesting in the streets.
7 to 8 million people?
Yes. Yes, that's
protested on Tuesday.
Yes, that's according to opposition sources. And you know, if this is the case, then this is where the mass movement is. The other thing is, you know, the conflict there in Egypt is very, very clear. It's between democratic movements or movements seeking democratic transformation and a tyrannical regime that has been in place for the last 30 years. The choices are very clear for people to take sides on this and for governments all over the world to take sides on this and for the U.S. government to take side on this, especially, you know, to continually preach democracy or about democracy all over the world and not to take a clear stand in support for pro-democracy movement in Egypt, especially given this, you know, the reports from human rights organizations for the last 30 years are really clear about the oppressive nature of this regime. So it's not very difficult to take a stand on this. And it's not very difficult, actually, to see that what's happening here is in many coverage of the media is actually there is a politically motivated coverage. There is a coverage that is based on essentially governmental press releases, adopting or accepting the some government's views on this issue. I'm not specifying one media outlet, but I'm not saying this is intentionally done. It could be just influence or just people trust some sources or trust their governments or trust you know, press releases from governments. But this is very obvious when a mass movement of 7 to 8 million people is in the street. That says the whole story.
But here's the thing, Professor Dana. If the if the reports we're getting are slanted in favor of government sources and government interests in Egypt, how then would you explain the fact that that these security forces masquerading as civilians who are being paid apparently to protest or to appear to be supporters of President Mubarak, that they went after reporters, the very Western journalists who are the eyes and ears that will represent their interest to the rest of the world. Isn't that a conflict of interest right there?
That's what you're saying. What you're saying is very true, but I'm talking about the whole picture actually here, because part of this picture also is the way some of the media is characterizing, for example, the current Vice President Omar Suleiman. This guy really is a unique kind of torturer, really an oppressor. I mean, the Egyptian people didn't have to wait for WikiLeaks, but after WikiLeaks, there is clear information on this guy, and it's his role in the extraordinary rendition is very very, very well documented now. People can read Jane Mayer's Dark Days, you know, just to see the details of the dirty role this person played in torture and oppression of his people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to characterize that as the alternative and the person who's going to carry the country through the democratic transformation is utterly false. I'm sure some of the journalists might not know the details of this man's story because he wasn't in the light throughout the previous period. But, you know, we have documents on this now. WikiLeaks, we have documents, you know, from interviews that many, many researchers done. As I just mentioned, Jane Mayer's book on this. So to characterize, this is part of, you know, the whole picture. This is exactly part of the whole picture. I'm sure, yes, that some foreign journalists were attacked, and that's really true, and that shows the dark side of this regime. And that shows the dark side of the current, you know, vice president who is actually managing the crisis on the regime side.
Mm-hmm. No, I'd like, Professor Don, I'd like to go back to something you said earlier, that this is a country, Egypt, in which there are about 1.5 million people in the security forces. Now, I'd like you to elaborate a bit on that and provide us with a bit of a breakdown of what you mean by security forces. You've commented earlier that there are over 300,000 people in state security.
Yes.
Now, when you say security forces, I understand there are multiple security forces and these
yes.
are separate from the military. So explain to us how that structure functions.
Well, they essentially have three branches of the security forces. One is called the Al-Amn al-Markazi or Central Security, which is one of the most oppressive ones. And that's number is about 300 to 350,000 people. There is also the police force, which is also oppressive, but less oppressive than the central security, and that also numbers in hundreds of thousands. There is also special forces for the Ministry of Interior, which is, I guess, part of what has been done in the last 2 days, excuse me, was carried out by the Ministry of Interior forces. They also number in hundreds of thousands. The estimate for these three branches, in addition to members of the, you know, some militant members in the ruling party, amount to almost 1.5 million people, and that's very excessive by every standard. You know, when people were citing the excessive size of the security forces in Tunisia, you know, there is 1.3 officer for every 100 people in Tunisia, which is almost 1.3% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is also excessive and amazing, you know, unbelievable. But when you look at Egypt, the situation is even worse. You know, there is more security officers than Tunisia, per 100 people than Tunisia, and that's, you know, on the other side, just imagine that the Egyptian army. And that's, I think it ranks number 10 in the world. It's under half a million. I think it's between 400 and 450,000
mm-hmm.
people serve in the military. And if security forces not only outnumber, but is triple the size of the military forces or the army, that shows the interest and the concerns of the regime. And one more thing,
mm-hmm.
I really want to note that one of the documents that was leaked from WikiLeaks, actually two documents, one dates February 2010, and it's a repetition of another document from 2008, shows that from the U.S. Embassy, the U.S. Embassy seems to not be happy with the Egyptian army essentially being geared and accepting a strategy towards protecting the country from an outside enemy, which is essentially what traditional army would do. And they wanted more, you know, to gear the military towards internal threats against the regime, which means that they were trying to not only, you know, again increase the number of security forces interested in that protects and guards that oppressive regime. I'm not sure if they were imagining any kind of internal threat for the regime, but that shows that even the army was you know, smaller in size, significantly smaller in size. They wanted also to include that to, you know, in the forces that oppress the people inside the country.
So the question here, though, speaking of the army and the military in Egypt, where does the army fit into this picture? On Wednesday, reportedly the military did nothing to intervene in these pitched battles that were being fought between the anti-government protesters and these security forces masquerading as civilian supporters of President Mubarak. But then today, for the first time, according to some reports I'm seeing, there was a thin line of soldiers backed by tanks and armored personnel carriers that appeared to have taken up some positions between the combatants. That's the wording that I've seen. What is the role that the military is playing now and will be playing in the next few days as this situation unfolds?
Well, essentially, the role of the army is to protect the state and not the government and not the regime. That's a distinction that the Egyptian army understood very well, and that was obvious, you know, from the beginning of the events. That is, it is there to protect the state and not the government.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the crisis reached a situation where it needed a serious solution, or needed a solution, especially, you know, that Mubarak was kind of stubborn until probably 2 days or 3 days ago, until Tuesday really, not to give up power. And the protesters in Midan al-Tahrir or the Tahrir Square were also, you know, insisting on their demands that he leaves. There was a crisis and the military had to intervene. I think what happened in the last 2 days and the role, you know, the non-intervention of the army was part of an orchestrated, you know, attempt for the intervention of the military. I think the military is the force that is in total control now of the country, not the president. You know, but we're not talking about a military here again. Yes, it is structured, it is built to protect the state, but it has all sorts of connections with external forces. So I think it's not going to take over, or it did not take really over, despite the fact that there is no declaration of such a takeover until now. But they are in control. I think they didn't
when you say that they have a lot of connections with outside forces, what outside forces are you talking about?
Well, essentially, everybody knows that the military is funded by the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not funded, but most of the funds that come to Egypt come to the military. The heads of the military usually are in contact in constant contact with the American government and American military. So they have their own obligations that they I think they would fulfill. We're not talking about, you know, nationalist figures here. We're talking about military figures. Yes, they understood their role to protect the state, not the government. But at some point when they intervene, their background will affect the kind of intervention that is going to happen. And so they're not going to intervene on behalf of the people or on behalf of the, you know, the protesters, and in the sense that they will adopt all their demands. Because the demands are really broad here. They're not just economic or simply some political demands. They're really broad, and I'm not sure the military will actually be able to adopt all of them. So this intervention will be kind of an attempt to restore stability to the country in some sense, but also to preempt some of the radical and serious demands that the Egyptian people are asking for.
Okay, we're talking with Professor Saif Dana. He's an associate professor of sociology and international studies at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, where he specializes in the Middle East and North Africa. Now, Professor Dana, this situation is clearly not sustainable. What is going to become of Mr. Mubarak and Mr. Suleiman, and when? And what role do you see for the Muslim Brotherhood and for Dr. Mohammed al-Baradei? Let's talk first about Mr. Mubarak and his inner circle. What's going to become of them and when?
Okay. Well, let me just put the context first. This is a popular revolution, and in popular revolutions of this sort, it's very difficult, really very difficult, to see the end very near. Even if Mubarak is ousted, this is a mass movement, and the repercussions of this movement in Egypt and in the region will continue to take place for some time. So we're not gonna really see, a fast restore of, or an easy restore of stability in the sense that we will have a government and we will be done there. This is a mass movement with broad demands, and we're not going to see the end of the story very soon, despite what might seem as the end of the story, that is a government or a new president or a new vice president. Now, for Mubarak, so that's exactly the context that we should perceive all the, you know, the unfolding of the events in the future will take place within this context. Now, for Mubarak is very much done. As a matter of fact, in Arabic newspapers, they refer to him as the former president since Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
He's very weak, and it will be very bad for Egypt for him to remain a president. And I think the military understand that. Even the inner circle understand that when he is delegitimized, it's not a personal issue here. That affects the power and the strength of Egypt vis-a-vis the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
He cannot represent Egypt anymore, being illegitimate the way he is after Tuesday. So he's very much done. Him and the military are seeking some what they call a dignified way out. Unlike King Farouk before, or unlike the Tunisian dictator Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, and that's why his proposal was to stay until September, the end of his term, and then not to run again. I'm not sure this will actually happen. Now it depends on many forces on the ground, but his power has already been transformed to Omar Suleiman, his,
mm-hmm.
his appointed vice president. Suleiman is not an accepted face, a person in Egypt. Maybe he will be able to do a role in the transitional or in the interim period, and I think that's kind of likely. I'm not going to say very likely, but it is kind of likely because all the forces are seeking a way out of this crisis and this situation at this point. So he might be able to do that if there is something clear about Mubarak's situation, that is, he resigns or he's ousted, or at least declare that he transformed all his power to his vice president, and he would be just there until September doing nothing. For al-Baradei, it's the time for capitalizing on the event, and many people are trying to do this, from Mohammed al-Baradei to Amr Moussa, who's the head of the Arab League, used to be Egypt's foreign minister before, and
mm-hmm.
used to be kind of popular before amongst the people. There is also the opposition forces, many other opposition forces that have a lot of interest at stake here. But I think until now, since Tuesday, the most powerful force actually is the young men in the street. It seems that, and even the Egyptian opposition is kind of reluctant now, because they did not expect such an organization. It seems that these young men are very well, and women are very well organized and know what they're doing. And even I think the opposition forces at some point started, seeing that they might actually constitute some sort of danger to them, in the sense that they will play a role in the future, and that will be at the expense of the opposition forces. So what we see is a very complicated situation now in Egypt, that some of the Egyptian forces want to capitalize and harvest what happened at this moment, because they think they will gain the more than if they wait, because other forces will participate.
Mm-hmm.
The regime want to end the situation at this point without a total collapse of the regime. And there is another force that is determined to end the rule of Mubarak and to start the beginning of the to begin a period of the disintegration of the regime,
mm-hmm.
and another replacement. Until now, there is no clear mechanism. I don't want to say that, but Al-Baradei has a proposal, and that is essentially to have a presidential committee of three,
mm-hmm.
to replace the current president, to oversee the rewriting of the constitution and the election law for an interim period. I'm sure that will improve his situation if he was one of the three person committee. That will improve his situation in the future.
Okay, quick question here. Where does the United States fit into this? And as you know, even though the Muslim Brotherhood is officially banned from operating in Egypt, and reportedly they do not have much of a following beyond perhaps about 10% or so of the population, nevertheless they do have a sort of outsized reputation. So where does the United States fit in to this equation? We have about 2 minutes remaining, and what's the role you see for the Muslim Brotherhood going forward?
Okay, I think the U.S. Mismanaged the crisis or the event. It could have came out clear. It would have been really much better for the U.S. and the U.S. interest to come clear from the beginning, at least since Tuesday, on the side of, you know, the democratic transformation and the movement calling for democratic transformation, not to try to be neutral, which is perceived in the region as being negative neutrality. As a matter of fact, there are so many characterizations now for President Obama that shows him as just another Bush in the region. So the U.S. did not manage this crisis very well. It was many steps behind the movement on the ground every time, and reacting to that was a terrible service to the American interest. On the other side, the Muslim Brotherhood are just another group. They're not the only group. They're not the first group. I'm sure they will, if there is a democratic transformation, they will have a representation. It's not going to be total control of the situation. Now, aside from this, there is a significant mischaracterization of this movement in the sense that the spectrum of the Islamic movement is very wide. And people confuse movements like the Muslim Brotherhood with terrorist groups like Al Qaeda, and that's not really true. They renounced violence 60 years ago, and they don't have a military wing. They've been working within the constitution, despite the fact that they did not agree with the constitution, and the constitution has been terrible, actually tailored just for the president and his son to be able to run and govern. They will participate in the process. We've seen a great example in Tunisia where the Muslim, the equivalent of the Muslim Brotherhood, because they don't really have that, essentially said they will not revoke
mm-hmm.
Any social achievements that the people of Tunisia did before, like, you know, the civil rights and women's rights, and they actually accepted that as an Islamic, as part of the development of Islamic way of thinking.
Okay, we've been talking with Dr. Saif Dana. He is an associate professor of sociology and international studies at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside, where he specializes in the Mideast and North Africa. Professor Dana, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
This is Listen, a sponsored commercial-free radio, WBAI New York. We are broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming live on the web at WBAI.org. We're very pleased to provide you there with an update on the Egyptian Intifada. And, of course, later on today on the WBAI Evening News, we'll be providing you with additional updates on the situation as events there unfold. Now, we shift our attention from Cairo to Johannesburg, where we're very pleased to report that former South African President Nelson Mandela is doing well and responding to treatment at his home this a week after his release from hospital. The 92-year-old anti-apartheid hero is receiving home-based care after being discharged from hospital last Friday following treatment for an acute respiratory infection. Officials said this morning that he was in stable condition, but he continues to receive close close monitoring around the clock from a team of specialists. Earlier, doctors looking after the elder statesman had voiced some concern over the number of visitors flocking to his bedside since his release from hospital. High-profile visitors, including President Jacob Zuma, have been streaming in and out of Mandela's Johannesburg home, while well-wishers are holding vigils for his continued well-being. Next Friday, February 11th, will mark the 21st anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release from prison. It's a historic turning point in the international struggle to end apartheid and usher in the birth of a new South Africa. It was one of the great theatrical and emotional moments of contemporary history when at 4:14 p.m. on the afternoon of February 11th, 1990, Nelson Mandela walked away from Victor Verster Detention Center outside Cape Town, South Africa. The world's best-known political prisoner was a free man at last, after 27 years in captivity.
Five minutes after the hour, Father of Our Nation. That's Jennifer Jones and Hugh Masekela with a selection from the original soundtrack to the award-winning film Mandela, Son of Africa, Father of a Nation. Mandela, next Friday, as I mentioned earlier, marks the 21st anniversary of his release from prison on February 11th of 1990, at 4:14 in the afternoon. Now, Mandela had been jailed as a terrorist for his part in masterminding the armed struggle of the African National Congress as it fought to overthrow the apartheid regime in South Africa and establish democratic majority rule. And though 21 years ago, he left jail both as an icon and as an international celebrity, Mandela knew that the hardest fight of his life was only just beginning. He still had to lead South Africa's black community to victory as the ruling white minority at last bowed to the inevitable change. He also had to ensure that there was a peaceful transfer of power and use all his political skills and stop the country from plunging into civil war as various groups, some of them black, had tried to stop the elections that would lead to the ANC taking over. Now, in doing so, Mandela would go on to demonstrate the qualities that he had developed during those long years in prison, a refusal to ever give in that was matched by a quite extraordinary understanding and forgiveness for his opponents. Nelson Mandela was to emerge as a unique figure on the world stage, for he was seen not just as a politician who could be trusted, but as an international statesman with an unmatched moral authority. So when you heard that piece a moment ago, Father of Our Nation, that tribute to Nelson Mandela, that, as I said, is part of the soundtrack, the original soundtrack to this documentary film, Mandela, Son of Africa, Father of a Nation. And I thought this afternoon, as we are 1 week away from the 21st anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release from prison, that we are going to feature this afternoon the focus. We're going to put the focus on Nelson Mandela, Son of Africa, Father of a Nation. And we're going to share with you excerpts from this biographical documentary on the life and work of Nelson Mandela. Now, this particular documentary was filmed over a period of 7 months leading up to the historic 1994 presidential election. It is an absorbing, full-length documentary looking at the courageous life and tribulations and fortitude of Mandela the leader, while never forgetting the engaging and charismatic spirit of Mandela the man. The film features exclusive interviews, and get this, the narration is by Mandela himself. It is directed by South African Joe Mendel, produced by Jonathan Demme. It was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. And the documentary, which was out of print for many years, is now available this afternoon on DVD. It's a two-hour biographical documentary on the life and legacy of Nelson Mandela. And we want to share that with you this afternoon, and also to make it available to you as a thank you gift when you make a pledge this afternoon to WBAI, a tax-deductible contribution to this radio station at the $85 level. That's it. Your $85 pledge to WBAI gets you this documentary, Mandela, Son of Africa, Father of a Nation. And it is accompanied, your $85 pledge gets you the documentary on DVD, accompanied by a very beautiful 48-page booklet telling the compelling story of the extraordinary life of Nelson Mandela. It's a beautiful 48-page book filled with dozens of photographs and art images, and an essay by the acclaimed British journalist Robin Denslow. So you get both of, you get these, the companion booklet, the 48-page booklet with these really high-quality photographs and art images and so on, and this essay on the life and work of Nelson Mandela, as well as this two-hour documentary film on the life and legacy of Nelson Mandela, narrated by Mandela himself, filmed over a seven-month period leading up to the historic 1994 presidential election, so that throughout the film, even as Mandela is relating, is narrating information about his life as a child, growing up, his early career, and so on, it is interspersed with Mandela's appearances throughout this seven-month period leading up to the election. So it's a really elegant, very beautiful, very well produced documentary directed
directed by the South African Joe Mendel and produced by Jonathan Demme. As I said, it was nominated. It was in the shortlisted for an Academy Award for Best Documentary, and we want to share it with you. The documentary actually begins with Mandela's childhood. It goes through his career. It's available with your pledge as a thank you gift at the $85 level. Now, get this. If you would like to make an additional contribution to WBAI at the $150 level, then we'll also add to that the original soundtrack, which has 28 cuts of music, some of which was specifically composed for the documentary, some of which reflects the music of the time over the period of the that is covered in the documentary. So we'll add into that the original soundtrack to the documentary, as well as there's a National Geographic map, an exclusively designed 20-inch by 30-inch poster map highlighting key events in the history of Nelson Mandela in South Africa with informative text and photograph and images. This is a National Geographic map exclusively designed, created just for this project. A poster map, 20 inches by 30 inches, highlighting key events in the history of Nelson Mandela in South Africa with informative text and photos and images. So you get the CD with the original soundtrack and the National Geographic poster map, in addition to the book and the DVD, with your pledge at the $150 level. At the $85 level, we'll send you the DVD and the booklet. And for my thing is, my very strong recommendation is that at the very least, you get the DVD and the booklet of this two-hour, beautiful, very magnificent documentary on the life and work of Nelson Mandela. Now, 92 years old, what a life that has been. The number to call is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. We're approaching, it is now 43 minutes after the hour. So we are almost three-quarters of the way into the first hour of the program this afternoon. I spent the first half hour of the program talking with Professor Saif Dana of the University of Wisconsin, and who is an internationally renowned expert on the Middle East and North Africa, and in particular on Egypt, because I thought that even though we are in fundraising mode, we're in the second day now of our winter membership and fundraising drive, we should not allow the ball to drop, and we do not allow the ball to drop here on Talkback. It is important that we continue to keep you apprised of the major and the major developments that are taking place elsewhere in the world, and the number one story that is unfolding right now with wide-ranging implications for all of North Africa and the Middle East, and indeed for the future of international peace and security, as they like to say over at the United Nations. That story is the Egyptian Intifada. And so I spent the first half hour talking with Professor Dana, providing the context and analysis on this Egyptian Intifada that would enable us to better understand what is unfolding. And having done that, and having now spent the last 15 minutes introducing this documentary, Mandela, Son of Africa, Father of a Nation, we are now asking you to go to the telephones and to make a pledge of support to WBAI. The number is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. You can use your Visa, American Express, or MasterCard. You can honor your pledge with a personal check or money order. You can use the electronic funds transfer system or the installment plan. 212-209-2950, and your $85 pledge gets you the DVD of this powerful two-hour documentary, Mandela, Son of Africa, Father of a Nation, and the companion booklet, a 48-page booklet, very beautifully done, handsomely bound, with dozens of photographs and art images, and an essay by the acclaimed British journalist Robin Denslow. 212-209-2950.
5-0. Please join those who are on the line right now. Time is of the essence. Let's go now directly to the DVD. We'll begin at the beginning, as they say. And while this presentation is in progress, we encourage you to call 212-209-2950. I'm hoping that before this is all over, we have at least 150 new and renewing members to talk back this afternoon, pledging at whatever level is convenient and comfortable for you. Thank you very much in advance for your support. Here now, Mandela, the son of Africa, father of a nation.
Years ago, Africans migrated south. The Xhosa nation settled with their cattle in the eastern part of what is now called South Africa. European settlers arrived in the middle of the 17th century. They fought the Africans and drove them off their land, sowing the seeds of hatred that lasted for centuries. It was here in the Eastern Cape that Nelson Mandela was born in 1918. He was of royal blood, a descendant of Tembu chiefs, part of the Xhosa nation. He was called Rholihlahla Madiba Dalibunga Mandela.
When I went to school, the lady teacher, Miss Mdingane, asked, "What is your name?" I told him my African name, Rholihlahla. He says, "No, I don't want that one. You must have a Christian name." So I say, "No, I don't have one." She says, "You are, from today you are going to be Nelson." That's how I earned the name Nelson. not given by my parents. In fact, my mother, who has never gone to school, took me one day to a doctor. And the doctor asked, now, what is his name? She said, Nelisile. His name is Nelisile. Because it was a white name, you see, and they couldn't pronounce it properly.
These graves mean a great deal to me because my beloved parents lie here. And it arouses a great deal of emotion for me to be here because it would be fair to say part of myself lies buried here.
Besimoyika ebethu ubufikile ubhuti engenandaba zakugeza anozithetha nani ubhuti ningenakugeze khona besimoyika le ndawo kuyakhe yobunkokheli sayibona yayibonakala esemncinci sasimoyika esoyikwa
besihlala equ izindlu ebesinazo phaya equ ibizizindlu zesixhosa ezenziwe ngenca lukamama ibidibene nekatata sinendlu yethu singabantwana yokubasela ikhona indlu yabafana basekhaya yamakhwenkwe
sakhula sizingela sihlala izinduku silusa izinkomo.
My father was a polygamist with four wives, nine children. I grew up in that atmosphere where we played together, fought against one another, but ate from one dish. We grew up in the felt, looking after stock, sheep, goats, horses, and cattle. Also, during the day, we do all sorts of things. You hunt rabbits, birds. One of our favorite pastimes was stick fighting. You have one stick on the left hand to parry the blows from the other boys, and then on the right hand, a stick to hit with. By the way, one of the marks of the sticks I still have. Yeah, there it is. I was hit here by another boy. My mother, she was my first friend in the proper sense of the word. She was not an emotional person. She was completely controlled, calm, at peace with herself and with the world. And I had a great deal of respect for her. A lady who never went to school, who could not read and write, but who was able to listen to the enlightened Christian in the village and became a Christian in spite of the fact that my father wouldn't come near Christianity. She was approached by those neighbors who were, according to the standard of the day, a bit educated, and asked that I should be sent to school. When I went to school, my father then gave me his writing breeches, and he cut it. And then they had a twine, which I used as a belt. And also he gave me his shirt. That is how I went to the school for the first time. Then one evening, I saw my father lying on his back and the two ladies attending to him, and I subsequently learned that he was ill.
Udada utasawugula, wabiza inkosi kwakusithiwa ngujongindaba. Wathi udada kujongindaba, mhlakazi, nasi isicaka sakho. Ndisinikezela kuwe ukuze umfundise lo mntana. Ngoba lo mntana ndiyambona uba inkqubela yakhe ibheka phambili. Uzumfundise, siya kukunyamezela isicaka sakho. Ndikhona ke ngokwatsho ndada.
Then one evening, he suddenly called to the young wife and asked her to bring her his pipe and tobacco. But because he was coughing, my parents, you know, my mothers consulted and decided not to give him the pipe. But he insisted. And now that I remember very clearly, calling upon the youngest wife, no diamond, give me my tobacco, give me my pipe. Eventually they couldn't resist the pressure and gave him the pipe and lighted it, and he started smoking. Then he became quiet. For some time he started smoking, and I just saw the pipe dropped. That's how he passed away. I went to Mkhwebezweni when I was 9. The regent, David Dalenjirgo, brought me to his place so that he could bring me up. He had 2 children. Justice, who was going to be the heir to the chieftaincy, and a daughter called Nomafu. He brought me up as his own child. He wanted me to be the chief counselor to the king. That was what I was groomed for. Where I grew up. That is the one. And we'll just go inside. I slept here with the future chief of this area, Justice Mtikawa, the father of the present chief. So he was a sportsman. He played rugby, played soccer, he played cricket. He was 4 years older than myself. He is a person who loved me very much. I grew up in Aningkuta. This was the royal court, the king's court. So you were dealing with elders of the tribe who were experts in tribal custom and law. as a boy, I would bring food to them. I would bring a beer to them. And I would perform errands for them. It was from them that I heard about the battles of olden times. The battles that were fought from the Fish River by the Xhosas. The series of wars over 100 years. Our people fighting with spears against gunpowder. They told these stories and the bravery of the traditional leaders who led those battles.
Become an advisor to the king, Nelson needed higher education, and with the support of the chief, he went to the best schools available to blacks.
The first college I went to, I concentrated on my studies. That is where I did my standard 6, form 1, form 2, form 3, in Clarkbury, the one we visited.
Minutes after 4, this is WBAI New York. We're listening to the sounds of Mandela, son of Africa, father of a nation. He's here on a visit to a school that he attended as a boy.
I have the knowledge to serve your country and your people. Out of you, we are going to have members of parliament, ambassadors, prime ministers. You are going to command our armies. Every one of you are potential leaders who, if they take the challenge, will change the face of South African history. And that is my dream. Diabole. Then I went to Hilltown in the Siskai for my trick. Now, the principal, Dr. Wellington, used to address us and say, I am a descendant of the famous Duke of Wellington who crushed Napoleon and saved civilization for Europe and for you, the natives. And those days will trap you, see. It was when I was in Hilltown that the poet Mkai visited the institution. And in the course of reciting, he called all the nations of the world to come before him because he was going to divide the stars. And he says, you Europeans, the English, the Germans, the French, I give you the constellation because it is the largest group of stars in creation. I am giving you this group of stars because you are greedy nations. You quarrel over plenty. You have started wars which have caused, brought suffering and grief to millions of people throughout the world. Then he called the nations of Asia and Africa. And at the end of it, he says, now you come, House of Xhosa. Inkwenkwezi ebaluleke ngaphezu kwezinye inkwenkwezi. Inkwenkwezi yokubala iminyaka. Iminyaka yobudoda. It is the custom amongst the Xhosas that when a boy reaches a certain age, he should undergo circumcision. It is so deeply entrenched that even in prison, prisoners circumcised one another. I was 16 years of age when we were taken to the circumcision school. We discarded our clothing and we were instructed to sit on new blankets with our legs open. And I heard the first boy saying, Ngeyindoda, I am a man. Which is what you're supposed to say the moment the expert has cut your foreskin. It is an assegai, a spear. Not sterilized, no anesthetic. He just catches your foreskin and in a quick movement, like this. And before I was aware of it, the operation was over. But the pain had gone right into my bones, into my marrow. And as this operation is being conducted, the men are looking very carefully in your face to see what your reaction is going to be. Because when you say, I am a man, they wanted to see it themselves. The body language must also say so. And I must confess that the pain paralyzed me momentarily, and I was not as forthright and strong as the other boys that preceded me.
Oh,
212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. 10 minutes now after 4 o'clock. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live on the web at WBAI.org. We're pausing here to give you an opportunity to, first of all, to assimilate that circumcision story. Both Michael G and I are squirming. You know, you're 16 years old when this is happening to you, with no anesthesia and so forth. You just heard him describe that. But it is the custom. So much so is it embedded in the culture. This is Nelson Mandela, of course, narrating the story of his own life, that in prison, prisoners would circumcise each other. Well, we're listening here to Nelson Mandela relating the story of his own life in the documentary, the 2-hour documentary film, Mandela, Son of Africa, Father of a Nation. This is a documentary that was filmed over a period of 7 months leading up to the historic 1994 presidential election, which of course was won by Mandela, he becoming of course the first black post-apartheid president in the Republic of South Africa. And this was a very momentous historic occasion, and that itself is an understatement. What I decided to do this afternoon, because we are 1 week away, next Friday, February 11th, marks the 21st anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release from prison on February 11th of 1990, after 27 years in prison, serving a life sentence, as you know, on terrorism charges. The rest, as they say, is history. And Nelson Mandela has led this extraordinary life. He's been an extraordinary historical figure in not only in South Africa, but as a global figure, as a worldwide figure. And we are making this documentary, Mandela, available to you this afternoon as a thank you gift, with your pledge at the $85 level. Your $85 pledge to WBAI gets you this documentary at 212-209-2950. We'll send you both the documentary and the companion 48-page book telling the compelling story of the extraordinary life of Nelson Mandela. This is a beautiful 48-page book.
In the spirit of March Madness and St. Patrick, Radio Free Erin will broadcast live from Percy's Tavern at 13th Street and Avenue A on the Lower East Side every Saturday in the month of March. Join a host of special guests like musicians Mary Courtney, Bernadette Fee, Patter Hickey, The Druids, and Brian Fleming of Djembe. Author T.J. English will talk about his new book, Savage City, and Brendan Fay will talk about marching in Queens in the St. Pat's for All Parade. Come for the music, come for the culture, come for the crack. Come join Radio Free Erin as we broadcast live every Saturday in March from 1 to 2 at Percy's Tavern, located at 13th Street and Avenue A on the Lower East Side. See you in March on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Hello, WBAI listeners and volunteers. During February, we will be fundraising at WBAI, and we need you. Call us at 212-209-2826 or email volunteer@wbai.org and sign up to answer our phone lines. We need volunteers all day, every day, from February 2nd through February 26th. Come down to the station located on the 10th floor of 120 Wall Street and bring a photo.